So, hi everybody, welcome those in class and those online. So, we've come to the third class of Nine-Eighths Potential. We'll begin as we normally do by setting a good motivation, an altruistic motivation. And I'll set up a visualization and we'll say some prayers together. Then I'll begin the class. So, in the class, there's a section there for asking questions. So, this material is a little deep in a way, it might be new to you. So if you do have sort of burning questions, please just write them down or hold them in mind until that little section comes. Otherwise, I'll probably run out of time. So the first thing is just to be comfortable in your seat. So make sure you are comfortable. Check to see if your back is straight and your shoulders are relaxed, that your head is sort of resting evenly upon your neck, and your hands are placed in a comfortable position. When you are comfortable, relax and let the body breathe itself. And feeling the body breathe itself. Relax into awareness. And then imagine that the ground beneath you is made of a starry sapphire light, which is very soft. And all the space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. And the space directly in front of you, on a throne, sitting on cushions of lotus, sun, and moon, sits the Buddha Shakyamuni. His body is made of radiant golden light, and he's wearing the three robes of a monk. And he is surrounded by the assembly of bodhisattvas, deities, and other enlightened beings. You yourself are seated upon your seat, and you are surrounded by all sentient beings. These include your parents, friends, difficult people and strangers. Now, take a moment to recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive. And while you are alive, you have the leisure and the opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. You will need to act quickly though, because things are not quite right. They change all the time. And this world does not exist as it seems to. Nevertheless, you do have a spiritual friend who is leading you in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones, the teacher, Buddha, his teachings, the Dharma, and the spiritual community of those who have realized emptiness, the Sangha. So make your offering of practice as purely as possible. Generate a mind that seeks enlightenment to benefit all beings. And then imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity and to be holding a mantra and bell, and you are sitting within a sphere of great bliss. Then from within the sphere of great bliss, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So in response to this wish of yours, think that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down and dissolve into yourself and all the living beings surrounding you. Your negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan are increased, along with your virtues and Dharma realizations. So cleansed by wisdom and empowered with love, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. And then decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings into those four immeasurable states. Then join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the vice of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So in response to this wish of ours, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all beings who surround you. Negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan are increased, along with your virtues and Dharma realizations. Feeling even more empowered, exhale and relax. And from that relaxed state of awareness, invite the field for accumulated merit, which appeared. And joining your hands together in the prayer mudra, say in front of them, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actually the mental. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cycle of existence and turn the wheel of Dharma from living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So having purified the mind, body and speech somewhat and accumulated some merit, to prevent ourselves from clinging to the purification and merit as truly existent, we imagine our body, speech and mind, our enjoyments and our merits are all utterly transformed into a pure land. And in this land, others will gather for us to give teachings to. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned on Mount Meru, four continents of southern India. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offered. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Nanda Kandayata Ami. So the offering was being made, and the Buddha accepts this offering and smiles at us with delight. And we look up into that smile and meet the gaze of the Buddha. And in those eyes, we find immense humility, deep wisdom, kindness, and acceptance. And we recollect the three principal aspects of the path, a wish to abandon suffering and its causes, the desire to become fully awakened for the benefit of others, and our understanding that all phenomena are without the inherent existence they appear to have, and instead arise dependently through designation and consciousness. Now, from the heart of Buddha Shakyamuni, infinite light rays emanate, reaching all environments of all beings. And everything dissolves into light, which dissolves into the Buddha. He diminishes in size, moves through space and enters the crown of your head and descends down to your heart. Your very subtle mind and the mind of the Buddha become a single entity. And within the one nature, you hear the mantra. And you begin to recite the mantra. Now from your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space, and every sentient being within space is utterly transformed into the fully awakened state. So the two purposes are now achieved. You've brought about your own enlightenment, and you help all beings to become enlightened. I think the purpose of this life has been achieved. And now I think that this is all taking place on the level of imagination. Nevertheless, it has imprinted the mind with this possibility, full awakening for the benefit of others. Whereas this has been your motivation, you've set in place the karmic seed for full awakening. So take joy in that. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open. In your own time, bring your awareness back into this room, move your body, wriggle your shoulders, get quite comfortable once again in your seat. Okay, so we've covered a little material so far. We defined consciousness to be an entity that is clear and knowing. So clear describes the nature, and knowing describes the function of mind or consciousness. We know that consciousness is subject to change. It changes from moment to moment. It changes because it's not under its own power. And that there are three continuities of mind. We've talked about the gross level of mind, which is our perceptions, conceptions, a more subtle level of mind, which can be accessed through dreams and through the process of dying. And finally, the most subtle level of mind of all, which is the foundation of the deepest foundation of consciousness. This is the consciousness that goes on from life to life to life. It experiences samsara, but it can also experience nirvana, the absence of all suffering. In our first class, we looked at the four reasons for having a fortunate human rebirth. So just a few of them are, you are very fortunate to be a human if you have all of your senses are intact, but you have some sort of faith in the teachings and so forth. This is a sort of unusual. There are major differences between the mind and brain. They are not one and the same. And we can discern this through their major differences. For instance, everything about the brain can be, or the vast majority of things about the brain can be measured. They're physical phenomena, but it's made of atoms. Mind, you cannot measure it. You can't even find it. There's a major difference between the mind and the body. The mind and brain. And then we looked at some of the reasons why the delusory states we experience, our afflictions, can be eliminated completely. But basically, this is because the mind itself, the basis of the mind itself, is pure, and these afflictions are adventitious. It means they require conditions to arise. And so we don't always experience them. And so that's to give us some hope. And finally, it's possible to cultivate powerful antidotes against the afflictions. So for instance, if we feel angry, then an antidote against that anger could be patience or loving kindness. While the mind is absorbed in patience or kindness, anger cannot arise, will not arise. But again, it should give us hope that we can actually deal with our disturbing emotions. This is the material we've gone through in the past. Now today, we're going to have a little look at what they call the primary minds, and there are six of those, and then what they call the mental factors, the factors that make up these primary minds. Now, the material I've relied upon are these six books in particular, but others also. If you were to start to read about this material, I'd probably suggest the best book to start with is The Foundations of Buddhist Practice, then go to Buddhist Psychology, and probably after that, Science and Philosophy. Now, it's quite dry material, so it's, you might not really hold your interest for too long. It's sort of like doing a PhD or a scientific dissertation with just lists of things with definitions and so forth. It's not easy to take this intellectual knowledge and sort of apply it. But I hope we'll have to do an experiment like that today in the class or in the last slides, just to give an idea of how useful this material can be. So I'm going to begin with a quote by one of the founders of our center and the organization, the FPMT, called Lama Yeshe. And so this comes from a book called Becoming Your Own Therapist. We can see here, he says, there is nothing spiritual outside. So my rosary isn't spiritual. My robes aren't spiritual. Spiritual means the mind. And spiritual people are those who seek its nature. So this is, I guess, we were sort of Buddhist psychology and also epistemology. So psychology is basically an analysis of the inner world of our own experience. And epistemology is the study of knowledge itself. How do we know things? How do we know what we know? And how can we test that it's actually valid? And according to Buddhism, epistemology and psychology go hand in hand. So when the study of psychology is taken or undertaken without the basis of epistemology and the methods of practice it suggests, there is a risk that it will remain a mere intellectual exercise. And not bring us any real benefits. So you'll see, well, not so much today, but later on as we go through, how I try to combine these two ideas, the methodology of knowing how you know, and then what it is that you know, like your inner states. So begin by looking at these primary minds. So first of all, define them and say what they are. So another name for primary mind is main mind. And the main mind is a cognizer, meaning a knower, that principally, or mainly, apprehends the mere entity of an object. So this primary mind is always present, and it acts as the basic foundation of our experience. So what are they? So in this picture here, I've got like a Superman-type character with rays of light going out of his eyes, right? And what that's to prove is that he's looking at something. So one of our primary minds is vision. Another is auditory consciousness, our ability to hear something. Another is taste. We have six of them. Five major senses. And the sixth one is mental consciousness. So these are called six consciousnesses or six main minds. Consciousness is associated with the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind itself. Now, this primary mind, it's very much like a clear cinema screen. So this is an analogy, right? It simply displays whatever appears. It doesn't address or add the story, the emotion, or interpretation to any of the images. Just a clear awareness of something. So like if you look around, your primary concept, one of these primary concepts is your eyes, right? And they're just seeing stuff. You see every color and shape in this room. That's all it does. Other consciousness, like a rising ball, how do you feel about that? Can you discern the blue from the yellow? Yeah, I can. You know. Your eyes have to make contact with these phenomena. So these are what they call the mental factors. The primary mind just gets at the object, whether it be sound, color, taste, and it needs an object. Like in, you want to see, you need your eyes. You want to hear, you need your ears. So these consciousnesses, all these states of awareness, arise in independence upon your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, mind. So the function of this primary mind is just to like apprehend the mere entity of it. There's nothing more than that. Basically, this main mind is sort of passive and neutral. It provides the essential ground of consciousness, but does not engage in the active process of interpretation, emotion, or conceptualization. And like I said, we have six of them. So we have a visual consciousness, an auditory consciousness, an olfactory consciousness, gustatory consciousness, tactile consciousness, and finally, mental consciousness. So understanding these six divisions helps us to recognize how different types of awareness operate, and it can support our meditation practice that observes the nature of consciousness itself. So in other words, this systematic division here into six main minds is to help us understand that while the primary mind is fundamentally like one in nature, meaning they're all clear and knowing, they all have the ability to know something, none of them are physical in nature, and they're able to sort of, what we talked about last week, sort of reflect the aspect. These main minds are sort of get at their objects like directly. They don't go through an image like when you think. If you think about a person, there's no real person there, is there? It's just your own image of it, right? That's how conceptions work. Perceptions get at the object directly. So I look at the person, well, you're right there. So there's quite a difference here in how they function. The analogy they give for these divisions of primary mind, you might have seen this in the six links, is a house with six windows in it. So each window is like a way of phenomena for you to apprehend the phenomena. This is like six different windows in the house. Each consciousness opens onto specific experiences. There are five for the physical senses, and one mental window for thoughts and memories. Now, how are these primary minds generated? Meaning, how do they arise, right? So here I've put up this image here of how to generate a primary mind. And what this primary mind is about here is the olfactory consciousness. You could use it for any consciousness, your visual consciousness, but here he's smelling the aroma of the wine, right? So he's got to use his nose. He's also got to have something to be perceived. So what's the object being perceived here is the wine in the glass. That's called an apprehending condition. That's the name they give to it. Secondly, it requires an immediate condition, which is called the preceding moment of consciousness. And finally, it has to have an empowering condition, the organ itself. The organ itself here is what? The nose. Excellent. That's right, the nose. The apprehended condition is the mind. That's right. And the immediate condition is the preceding, the olfactory consciousness. The consciousness associated with the nose. Now we need that consciousness there because if the fellow was a corpse, right? So his nose would be there and the wine would be there, but he'd not be able to apprehend So consciousness is required. In fact, all these conditions are required because if there's no wine there, he could be conscious and have his nose, but he's not going to smell wine, is he? And if he's lost his nose, he can have the wine there, but he can't apprehend the smell of it. So all these three, they're all required for a main mind to access its object. You can move this across to vision, for instance. Suppose he wasn't smelling the wine, but yeah, they do. They look at it. They hold up. They look at it sometimes. So they go, oh. I don't know what they call that, but they do look at it. Right? So what's the apprehended object there?
Wine.
Wine. That's right, he's looking at the wine, right? The empowering condition would be the
Eyes.
eyes. That's right, now he's looking. This is amazing, he's looking at the color of this wine. Right? And he has to have a consciousness associated with the eye organ. Otherwise, there's no apprehension of the color. So what you can do is you play around again. If the fellow was a corpse, dead, his eyes would still be there, wouldn't they? The wine would still be there, but he wouldn't be able to apprehend it. There's no visual consciousness associated with the eye. If the eye was taken out, if he was blind, you have the wine, consciousness, but it has no organ. So all three are required to access any object and for this consciousness to work. Right? We remove any one of them and the whole thing falls apart. All three are required for a main mind to work. Now there is a difference here. So it starts off, trying to do it simply. We start off with something physical. Right? But we know that all objects aren't physical. We also have mental objects, right? We have thoughts and memories. So what's the organ we're using there?
Mental.
Yeah, that's what they call it, a mental organ. Mental organ, not form. Yeah, so it's just called a mental organ.
It the
No.
brain?
That's a good question. That's why you've got to ask that, right?
It's the organ part.
That's right.
That's it. But
Yeah.
no.
So while the sense consciousnesses depend on physical organs, mental consciousness has consciousness, not form, as its organ. So as an analogy, like a fire needs fuel, oxygen, and heat to ignite. Consciousness needs object, a previous moment of consciousness, and the organ to arise. You remove any one of them, just like in a fire, you don't get a fire. Same here. If you remove any of those objects, you don't get a main mind. Mind can't function. So what do we do with these primary minds? So basically, there's two major things. So in these pictures, I've put a lot of boats in there, and there's a reason for it as we come along. Right? So I've got this one here. There's a fellow, he's sitting in his boat, and you see his legs crossed. He's listening to music, and he may be thinking something about it. So in terms of the mental consciousness, it's objects, or you apply mental mental, you apply your mental awareness to ideas, thoughts, concepts, names. These are the objects that you get out of the mental consciousness, memories, thoughts. These are the objects. The other things are physical objects. So these main minds, we have forms, so the eye could get at visual forms, colors and shapes, the different sounds, the smells, tastes, and the tactile sensations. So, you know, like for instance, your nose doesn't create thoughts or memories or concepts. Neither does your touch. None of those things. All of that comes from the mental stuff. So, there's like a division here. Mental consciousness gets at concepts, memories, thoughts, names. All the other consciousness get at physical objects. The mental consciousness gets at mental objects, the physical senses get at physical objects. So again, this is from Lama Thupten Yeshe, and he says that your mind is like a mirror, reflecting everything without discrimination. If you have understanding wisdom, you can control the kind of reflection that you allow into the mirror of your mind. So what do you think that means? It might be a little dense. So you know that when you put up a mirror, whatever you put the mirror, whatever's in front of us is going to appear in the mirror. And he's saying, look, your mind is just like that. Whatever you put in front of it is going to appear to you. Like you can see everything from me backwards, I see everything from you backwards. It just appears to me. Then he says, it's not that I'm concerned. Stuff happens. The stuff appears. Like in a mirror, it just reflects it, doesn't it? But for us, we have this reflective capacity too. Like the stuff appears to our minds. But something else also happens, doesn't it? Like you can feel things about that. You can feel stuff about that. Like I don't like you. I look at you, all is happening that I'm seeing, but then my mind starts to work. The mirror never does that. It just accepts it all in. And many of us are the same, right? We just allow stuff to come in. But if you know by your allowance of that, you're affected by that, what might you do? In terms of your eyes, for instance, visual consciousness, what might you do? What do little kiddies do? Close their eyes, they go, I don't want to see that. That's right, you're blocking out. For us, we might go like that. There's a bad sound, we might just block our ears, right? We're not letting that in. So this is what he's saying. If you understand this, you can do something about it. But not only that, but something just comes in. We can actually change how we feel about it. We can bring up thoughts. This is what we're going to come to shortly when we talk about the mental factors. Ben, you're going to say something? Or?
I was going to say, like, in terms of mental objects arising, which are bad thoughts or whatever,
yeah.
You can just close your eyes to them and say, it's not going to go.
That's right. You can disengage. The simplest thing you can do is think of something else or put on some music or go and watch a movie. Yeah? Those sorts of things, they're taken up by something else. So this is very good for us, isn't it? It means we can change the mind. Whereas a mirror really can't. It just has to reflect what comes in. And it doesn't have feelings about it, whereas we do. And we have ideas about what's appearing to us. Mirrors don't do that. We do. So we can change whether we allow it in, and then we can change our ideas about it. But here, this main mind is really, very much like a mirror. It just takes the stuff. Right? Does it appear? Yes, Chris.
Does the mirror then not reflect inherent existence?
Now the mirror doesn't, because no inherited existence whatsoever, right? It can't do that.
It's direct perception, right? We can't, direct perceivers can't directly perceive
inherent existence.
Because
it doesn't exist.
It doesn't have inherent existence.
No, that's right. That's right. So as I said, so I put this slide called What's Interesting. This allows you guys to ask any questions. Ben, shut up. Yes, Ben.
I've got three, but I'm going to go from the priorities.
Okay.
When it says the immediate condition is a preceding
moment of consciousness,
does that suggest that the consciousness has got to be there before the event can be?
But it's like, you think about that, it's like,
a mind-only perspective.
Yeah, it'd be sort of like, so mind would have an intrinsic nature.
Yeah, it'd be that, and then the event can happen.
Yeah, that's right.
Is it more like they all sort of coalesce at the same time?
No, the consciousness arises in dependence upon, like, for instance, the object and this other organ. Then it's going to arise.
So all three are interdependent.
Yeah, but it can't come from nothing, remember?
Yeah.
So it requires, consciousness requires a cause.
Would that mean be alluding more to a stream of consciousness?
Yes. Right. So that the cause must come before the effect. And the cause will transform into the effect, which is consciousness, right? So this is preceding moment. But I know it's hard to get your head around that when you hear it, because it's like, so it's just waiting there, is it?
Yeah.
I know. It's not non-existent, but it's not truly existent either. It's dependently existent. Yeah, they're all mental images.
Even though they were based on, originally on a physical sensation.
Yeah.
Right. That's really confusing. Because it's like you can bring it up vividly, like as if it's really happening.
Yeah.
Almost the same as if it exactly happened.
Yeah, no. So especially if you have dreams.
I think you can bring it up is the answer. Right?
Yeah.
If you can bring it up. You point it. If you can bring
it's
it
up. It's mental.
But the original experience is based on a physical thing.
But the after effect is mental.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
That's my question.
Okay. Actually, there's quite an interesting discussion about that in the books I've been reading, Ben, about these obviously like when you experience them in dreams. So sometimes, like I've had a dream, like I've actually felt the object. It was really shocking because I woke up, you know. But it was a dream awareness. It wasn't the actual thing I was touching. In fact, like I was touching my arm, but I thought I was touching something else in my dream and I was feeling it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, in dreams, it's not visual consciousness because your eyes are closed. But still, pictures appear, but they're all objects of mental awareness. Some of them are called dream objects.
It's weird, isn't it? Because I'm an ex-smoker. I can dream smoke. I smoke in my dreams.
Okay. Oh, wow. Very powerful imprints. Memories. And often when that happens, isn't it? We can't tell that they're dreams. We think whatever appears to it. So Ben was asking, for those online, What's the object of mental awareness?
Like, what's the mere entity of?
What's the mere entity of a mental awareness? There's going to be a perception of something.
Mind.
Yeah, but the thing that they're perceiving is an object of some sort, isn't it? Yeah. Because it requires those three conditions, right? There's got to be an object to be perceived.
Would it be the mere arising of thoughts?
Sorry, the mere
arising of thoughts? Would that possibly be what it is?
No, it could be.
Right.
It's just sort of any mental object. Like a memory could be your thing. It's your object, the mere memory.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, this comes up, this is the last thing we'll do. Right. We're going to do an exercise about this. Exactly. I thought this could be good because make it more realistic for us. But that's coming up. So the most important things to take away from what I just presented is that the primary mind is sort of passive awareness. What we're going to talk about next are the mental factors, and they're the active interpreters of this passive awareness. And the easiest ways to look at this is, look, one of them just watches. and the other does things to what is watched. So the main mind is just sort of like, if you look at vision, just watch it. It just apprehends the entity. If it was your ear consciousness, it would just apprehend sound, just the sound. But as we know, it gets very, very quickly quite involved. And what makes this involvement take place is what they call the mental factors. And that's the next thing we're going to talk about. So why does this matter to us? So understanding consciousness helps reduce the emotional reactivity that we can have towards objects, and it can also increase self-awareness. It teaches us to distinguish between what's called pure awareness and mental commentary. The mental commentary is all the mental factors. That's what they do. And that's, like I said, we'll talk about that very shortly. And the relationship between these main minds and these mental factors. A little meditation, then we'll begin the second part. Again, so meditation just means becoming familiar with your object. So here, just becoming familiar, what we'll be talking about, and sort of cultivating an awareness of that. So you get comfortable in your seats again. Just lift your shoulders and fall down and make sure that your spine is straight. Your head is resting naturally upon your neck and your eyes can be open or closed. And you want to just let the body breathe itself. So now try to become aware of awareness itself. In other words, turn your attention towards awareness. Awareness is the knowing quality that experiences thoughts, sensations, sounds, feelings. So your main mind, the primary mind, is like a clear cinema screen. It simply displays whatever appears without adding a story, without adding emotion or interpretation to what's experienced. So right now, that sound of traffic, you don't add anything to it, the ears, conscious, just apprehend it. And this is neutral, a neutral main awareness. So when you can recognize this neutral foundation, we stop being caught in the drama of our mental stories. And we can find peace in pure awareness. So is it possible for you to notice the difference between awareness itself and the thoughts that appear within it? The primary mind is like a clear cinema screen. It simply displays whatever appears, doesn't add anything else. So would it be possible for you to observe any thought that you might have and not engage with its content? Just try that out. I wonder how recognizing this neutral awareness that might change your relationship to difficult emotions. It's possible to rest in clear awareness. And you can do this throughout the day. At any time, you can remember the cinema screen of consciousness. The screen is blank, open, clear. If you can rest in the minds and the primary minds of nature, you can bring yourself lasting peace and stir the wisdom that's inherent to that mind. So let's breathe into your nostrils now. Exhale. With your eyes open. Move your body whichever way you like. So now we're going to have a look at these mental factors. So I'll begin by defining them. We will look at the function and the different divisions of them. So first, let's begin with the defining of mental factor. So I've got this little picture called entering area 51 down there. That's because, in general, in terms of the function of mental factors, there are 51 different mental factors. There's a lot of them. Perhaps there's even more than 51. So the definition of a mental factor is a cognizer that principally apprehends a particular attribute of an object. What's that sort of mean? So a cognizer is just like a knower. What its principal job here is not merely apprehending the mere entity, but the attributes of that entity. So if you lift this shot, lift this up, you just see like, what is that? Just say, well, that's a clock, right? Your eyes that apprehend this object called a clock. And it is that, but then it's this thing that you might look at it and go, it's a small clock. Or look at the numbers. Those are all the, what you might call the aspects or characteristics of a clock. When you say it's white, it's small. These are characteristics. That's, the main mind is not doing that. That's what the mental factors do. They look at the characteristics. Now, these mental factors, they accompany every main mind and they share specific characteristics with it, but they perform quite distinct functions. Now, at the very end, I'll give you some different analogies to show you how they work. But one of the simplest ones is like the hand. So if I hold my hand up like that, what do you see? You see my hand, don't you? Well, what else do you see?
A ring.
A ring?
Fingers.
Fingers, right? How many are there?
Five.
There are like five of them, right? So the main mind is like the hand. But wherever they go, this hand goes, the fingers go. And they get things. But it's the fingers that do the work. That's what the mental factors do. They do different types of work. And there's a lot of them going on whenever the mind moves. In fact, I've read of one place, it's like, it was a lot. About more than 30 mental factors going on at once. But whatever one of the things, as we'll come to, I'll show you, is wherever this mind goes, there's always five mental factors for sure that always go with them. If the object is virtuous, then there's 10 for sure. Okay? Then if it's the virtuous, then what virtue? So there's another one, and so on and so on. Now, why is understanding this important? Because it helps us recognize how consciousness operates through these various active components that color and determine our experience of the object. They can support meditation practice and mental training. So mental factors are the active cognitions accompanying the passive primary consciousness. But so like this, like a main, so I've got this clock here, I've got like this, so I just put my hand on it. That's like the main consciousness, passive. Feel my fingers, go like this, right? They start engaging with it. That's what the mental factors do. So it's my thumb, I start rubbing along here, my thumb makes contact with it. What's it feel like? That's another mental factor, feeling, contact. I intend to move those fingers, that's another one. My attention is on this, that's another one. So all these different mental factors come along with the main mind. So what's this, like I said, the function of the mental factor? You actively engage with the object through specific roles like feeling, discernment, intention, attention, contact. There's lots of different things. But none of those things themselves are a main mind. They're all mental factors. And the important thing to realize is here, the mental factors cannot arise independent of that main mind. They come along with it. The very same time the main mind gets an object, there's mental factors there. So we can have, yeah, no matter what awareness we're using here, there is no awareness without mental factors. Interdependent, what they call concomitant. They suit like different functions, right? But they're always together. So the mental factors actively engage with the objects through specific roles like feeling and so forth. And what the feeling, feeling as a mental factor does, it experiences the object to be like pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So this is, you can try this out with yourself, right? You just grab an object and look at it. If it was a visual object, right? You could look at it immediately and go, so what, how's it feel? How's the pen feel? You know, so I'd say for me, yeah, so it might be light, right? That's discrimination. That's the mental factor of discernment. I discern it to be light. Well, what's it feel? Pleasant? Unpleasant? Or is it sort of neutral?
Kind of pleasant.
Okay, kind of pleasant. Yeah, that's right. You know, if I touch this, you get a feeling. Whatever you put, I've got this, what's the term for the bodily feeling?
Somatic.
Sorry, body. Somatic. Somatic. Kinesthetic.
Tactile.
Tactile. Thank you, Ben. Tactile consciousness, right? So here's my tactile consciousness. Hasn't made any contact yet with that glass, right? I've got an intention. There's a mental factor at work. My attention is on the glass. I have an intention to touch it. There's two mental factors. Contact, third mental factor. I feel something. You do it with any object, that's how it's going to work.
Can I give an example?
Sorry?
I think might fit.
Yeah.
When I go, when we went through that thing before, I thought of an orange.
Sure.
And the orange was really nice and bright.
Sure.
And it looked like it was in season.
Okay.
And then the mental factor that kicked in for me was, that will taste really good.
Yeah.
But I haven't actually tasted it.
No.
So is that sort of the difference between the primary mind?
Well, the primary mind has already generated this orange shape thing, right?
Yeah.
Then there's, because it's done so, it appears. Mind has made contact with that mental object. There was an intention behind that, and your attention is on it. So there's three mental factors in play right there. In fact, wherever you put a main mind, we'll come to this shortly, there are five that are always there. And we're going to play around at the very last slide with this. You know? So what I do with the physical object, a cup of tea, and the other one, the mental object. When you think of something, I thought, you know, we often think of either good things or bad things, right? You can do it with either object. it doesn't matter because it's a mental object. So the five omnipresent mental factors are there. And no matter what type of awareness you have, whether it's based on the physical senses or the mental, there's five mental factors that are always there. And in fact, they're called omnipresent mental factors.
You're describing like the main mind, but like yep. just touching the glass.
Yeah.
You've already engaged sight.
That's right.
Then the mental factors have driven you to pick the glass up.
That's right. Yeah.
But then it comes back to the main mind again because touch is the main
mind. Another one again, isn't it? That's
then
right.
You've got hearing potentially and all those other senses.
Yep, that's
all
right.
The main mind.
They're all main minds. Each one is different. That's right. And each one of them will have those five omnipresent mental factors. It's full on, isn't it? That's right. It's not, let's just say. So the key insight is that basically the crucial insight is the mental factors. Yeah, we talked before about the screen, right? The bare screen, like the movie screen. It's got nothing on it. But anything can arise in it. So whatever does, this is through with the mental factors. The mental factors are there. As soon as that object appears, the mental factors are there. So it's like, so whatever comes on that screen, all the colors and all that, yeah, that's the mental factors. So mental factors color and determine our understanding of the main mind. Again, the main mind is much more neutral and sort of unadorned. And there's lots of practices of just trying to get to main mind and rest in it without all the overlays and all the colors and all that sort of stuff, right? Just to get to the nature of the mind itself. But even that, the five omnipresent factors are there. It's like, you know, I've got this hand. Wherever I move my hand, my fingers go. They're always there. That's how main minds and omnipresent mental factors work. Like I said, there's many others that can also be there. So here we go. So there are six divisions of the mental factor, and next week we'll talk about other divisions. But this is just this one of talking about the function of these mental factors. So first of all, we have what they call the five omnipresent mental factors. I'm not sure if you can see that so well. So they are contact, intention, attention, feeling, and discernment. In the books, of course, they go through each one of these and we'll take them and define them and go over it. Later on in our classes, I'm going to take feeling, because feeling is a really important one for all of us, and talk to you about what feeling is and so forth. So it's called their omnipresent. They're always present wherever main mind is, these are there. Then they have this other five called determining factors, and these have to do with the object itself, especially virtuous objects. These are always there when the object is one of virtue, but they're not all there when it's a neutral object or a non-virtuous object. So you see here, like, there's wisdom involved here. So that's not going to be in terms of a non-virtuous object. So here we've got aspiration, resolution, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Then there are 11 virtuous mental factors. So what can I say? They always thought there's faith, sense of shame, embarrassment, non-attachment, non-aversion, non-hatred, I think.
That's right.
And then there are the five others that are always not so good on. Yes, please, Chris.
Yes, so
pliancy, conscientiousness.
Diligence.
Sorry?
Diligence.
Pliancy.
Faithfulness or conscientiousness.
Conscientiousness, equanimity, and and non-ignorance, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it says
non-violence. Non-hatred, yeah. So these are 11 virtuous mental factors. So, for instance, if you were onto an object of virtue, you would have 10, 11 straight up. 11 mental factors going straight away. Accompanying your main mind. Now, there are six root afflictions: attachment, hatred, ignorance, afflicted pride, deluded doubt, and afflicted views. And in the afflicted views, there's another five of them. So there's quite a lot going on. Then there are the secondary afflictions. So I'll just put a few up there, but these, there are 20, and they're all associated with the six root afflictions. And finally, we have what they call the four variable mental factors. So to say they're variable means they could be neutral, but they can change into non-virtue or virtue. So sleep, for instance, is basically a neutral mental state. It's not negative, it's not positive, it's not non-virtuous, not virtuous, but it can become either, depending upon the motivation for sleeping. The motivation, basically, but there are some natural virtues. And these are the natural virtues. These minds do not produce suffering. Yes, plenty, plenty of times. In fact, that's the case many times. It often depends upon the object.
But
that's right, that's right. Many lie dormant.
Depending on
what you're engaging with.
Yeah,
which is object ascertaining, or what they call the determining mental factors, that has a huge impact on what other mental factors will follow. So you can see there's a lot, this is quite a presentation of mind, isn't it?
It's funny because you look at your mind and think it's clear, simple, all this stuff actually going on.
Well, it can go on, that's right. There's a potential to have all this go on, many of these things to go on. And we sort of, in a way, we sort of know that, but we forget. Why I'm saying that is because, like, we can go from the state of being mass murderers to enlightenment. So if you think about that, like, what's going on inside the mind of a murderer, a serial murderer or a mass murderer? That's right. That's right. And then on the other side, you've got really kind, compassionate people. And that's mind, people with those lovely minds.
It is interesting to note that it's slanted toward, that it's heavier towards the negative
side. That's right. Yeah.
But that's also your take on things.
Sure.
You know, that's what you see.
Sure.
Eddie,
yes.
I've got a question. If once we become a bodhisattva and we start working through the bhumis, does that mean that we start, you know, working on our afflictions and start kind of dropping them? Does that mean that eventually we drop the secondary afflictions and then we drop
and the root?
So, and on our way working through the bhumis, is that where it happens?
Yes, that's
we start
right.
Dropping some of these divisions.
So many of these the afflictions, on one level, they're artificial. They're very easy to deal with. But on another level, they're not.
Yeah.
And that's what they call the innate afflictions. The ones that go on with us from life to life to life, that are quite deep, all rooted in the misconception of who we are and the reality. That's the deepest stuff. Yeah, that's right. They're the conditions to produce more of it. So the idea behind this is, I guess, the takeaway is it's like a systematic organization of 51 mental factors to provide us, or the practitioners, with a comprehensive framework to understand and work with the complex activities of consciousness. If we wish to train our minds, we need to know about these phenomena, how they arise, what they do to us, what's the harm being created. To be certain, our own minds, these ones we've got to get rid of, and these other ones we need to develop more. Because these ones produce greater suffering for ourselves and others, whereas the others produce greater happiness for ourselves and for others. So that's why it's such a large category, I guess. So how these things actually function. So as an analogy, it says mental factor categories, so this is the six divisions, there are many others, which we'll talk about next week, are like different departments in a company. Each has specific roles. From essential operations, which are always present, to specialized functions, the object ascertaining, to quality control, the wholesome and the afflictive. Now, we don't get to generating these mental factors. So like I said, some you don't have to generate, they're always there. They make up the phenomena we call mind. So again, I brought the boat in, right? So here, mental factors basically arise simultaneously with whatever the primary consciousness is. And while they do so, they share five features, and yet at the same time, they perform specialized active. So this unified functioning enables a complete conscious experience, with the mental factors providing the active functions while the main minds provide passive awareness as the foundation. So in fact, mental factors, the understanding of it, or the way we might be able to look at it, is like an orchestra with the musicians all playing together. Each has specialized roles. So if you look back at these mental factors, he's got specialized roles. The afflictions, the root and the affliction, the role is to cause suffering, to cause misery, to keep us in samsara. That's their function. The virtuous ones are to help us get out of samsara. And like I said, so the omnipresent and the determining ones, the object ascertaining, we want to find these objects of virtue, place the mind on those. And that's what, you know, aspiration to do so. It's a mental function. To be resolved to do so.
Would it be, could you say that determining ones are virtuous as well?
No. But they're neutral. These two lots are basically neutral.
Right.
It depends, it depends what to place the object on. So you can contact, you can make contact with a non-virtuous object.
Yeah. Says even bees need mindfulness.
That's right. Yeah. Even the thief needs to remember what to do. Yeah, so the first 10 are basically neutral.
Right. But they seem
but meaning they can change whatever the object is, right? They become virtuous when you place them on a virtuous object. They become non-virtuous when you place them on a non-virtuous object.
Yeah, I guess you could be very mindful thief.
Oh, you should be. If you want to be successful.
Exactly.
You have to be. Yes. But then, well, it seems to be, isn't it? But the thing is, they have a different meaning than what we normally take it to mean. That's right. So you get these words in. I had the same. I used to have this conception of shame and embarrassment. I don't want to be embarrassed and I don't want to feel ashamed. But this is not about being ashamed. No, it's not feeling of being shamed, rather. So they're virtues, for instance, because shame is like an inner knowledge that you've done something foolish, and which means you're going to suffer. So that means, do you want to feel that? The answer probably like no. And that's what shame is telling you. Don't do this for your own good. Don't hurt yourself like this. Whereas embarrassment means basically everybody else knows that you've been an idiot, right? Is that what you want? And you go, no. So in fact, I say there's no practice of virtue without shame and embarrassment. It's so integral to the practice of virtue. I'm sorry? No. Do you see guilt? No, guilt is seen by Buddhist as a wrong consciousness. With guilt, you attack yourself. Yeah, and that's like the way to go.
That's in the Western world, that's really how we understand shame. Shame is a rejection of oneself.
Yeah.
And I think you were actually describing guilt. as but that.
It's why Buddhist definitions are different.
Yeah, very different. No, they're not. Here, this is positive.
It's actually what makes people do the worst possible things in the world. I worked with a director who had previously been a Jesuit priest and worked with men on death row in the States, and the underlying emotion that put each single one of them there was shame. That's what made them do the most heinous crimes that put them, that gave them the most heinous punishment.
Yes,
it was shame.
Yeah, and what's the shame directed towards?
The shame is rejection of oneself.
Right, so this is not that.
Mm.
This is not that. The shame is the rejection of the non-virtue. Yeah. That's what shame does. It says, oh, this is going to cause me suffering.
It's a different perception of the same
word. No, the object is different.
Yeah,
right? No, the object different. Is different. This one, the object's the person. This object is the mental factor. Right? The mental factor of the root afflictions.
English definition.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And then it can be the same word. But they're looking at it a different, slightly different way.
Whoever translated them initially, I think, made a mistake, because I was looking at Serbian words, and Serbian words are much more in tune with the Buddhist, like Buddhist Serbian words compared to regular Serbian words.
Yeah.
So English, whoever translated to English, they originally had misperceptions.
Or was it just word best fit? That's the, I've got an understanding of what that word means, and the English translation of it all. That's the closest I can get.
Okay, so the application of these mental factors. So, as specialized active functions that arise simultaneously with the passive main minds and they form a unified consciousness. So like I said, so here, now my fingers and the palm of my hands, it's all unified, isn't it? It's all called the hand. But it's the same thing, we've got this phenomenon called mind. So we've got this, the bare thing of getting at it, but then within it are all these mental factors, and they make up this mind. Without them, you don't have a mind. So, and these factors, they're not the same thing, but they arise simultaneously with it. So wherever these minds go, like wherever my hand goes, my fingers go. Wherever these minds go, these mental factors go. Especially the five omnipresent ones. The other object ascertaining, if it's an object of virtue, they're there. Then you've got another one, because what's the virtuous object? What's the virtue you're creating? So they've got 11 straight away. If it's on the negative side, you're going to have 11 straight away, but then you might have some of the other 20 that go along with it. Because remember, the mind is not stable. It's changing all the time. So you go from one state like anger, then move into resentment, and then go to hatred. So it's very quickly moving along. So again, this is from this lovely book called Science and Philosophy in Indian Buddhist Classics, Volume 2. So he says, at the heart of this mind map is a distinction between the mind and mental factors. The first referring to the basic fact of awareness, and the latter referring to aspects or dimensions of our mental life. And it's defined in terms of the distinct functions. Now, there's a lot of material, of course, that's interesting in this, as I can see, you took off in a discussion. But some of the interesting phenomenon about this is like the active versus the passive nature. But passive nature of the main mind, but then these mental factors are all active within the passivity. And the other thing is the simultaneously arising of the mental factor with the mind. And they're a simple entity, there's a unity there. So the idea of having all these and training yourself in knowing when they're there. Like, what's going on in my mind? What's arising? What's present? Especially in terms of virtuous mental factors and non-virtuous mental factors. You know, like, you'll know straight off your mind has made contact with an object. It has you have your attention on it. What's the intention that's going with it? There's a lot of stuff you'll know pretty quickly. just by trying this out, which I'll show you shortly. But the idea is to get a better understanding of how mental processes work, so we can diminish the suffering we cause to ourselves and others. We can lessen it and then finally get rid of it altogether. And on the other side, increase the positive mental factors so that we become happy people, we relate to others better, and we basically earn harmony and happy. Cool. So a quick meditation. Again, just get comfortable in your seat. So you're breathing normally and naturally. Your awareness is present. What do you notice in your consciousness like right now? Your mental factors are actively engaged. You can feel your own sensations. You can recognize objects, the door just closed. You recognize the sounds of traffic passing by. You can actually direct your attention to that sound or to some other object. All of these functions are arising simultaneously with your passive awareness. They're working as a unified experience. Does this change your understanding of your mind? The complete experience results from both neutral awareness and active cognitive function, which colors your awareness. And the mental factors never arise independently, but are always part of a complete conscious unit. And now breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale, let your eyes start open. So here are some metaphors that demonstrate the relationship between the main mind and the mental factors. So first we just start with the screen and its images. And like I said, the main mind is just passive, neutral. Everything appears on it, there's all the mental factors at play. Another one is the king and his ministers. So the king stays in the court because, and all the ministers run around, they do everything for him. Mental factors are like that. Another is a candle and its rays of light. But so the candle stays still, the lights, that all the rays go out. They're like the mental factors. There's a phenomenon called light. Well, the lights there, they are rays of light. They're like the mental factors. There's one entity, aren't they? The rays are not independent of the light, but they make up the light. The hand and its fingers, that's what I use quite often. And lastly, a stew. So you've got this meal, but it's made up of all these other things. And you call it stew. Right? So it's not mind. Right? We've got this phenomenon called mind, but it's not one thing. it's a heap of things.
These mental factors, are these only working concomitant with the mental main mind or other main minds as well?
Whichever main mind you use, the five omnipresent mental factors are always at work. Right. Wherever, no matter what consciousness is, they're always there. That's what they call omnipresent. So these all metaphors reinforce the idea that the main mind is neutral and the passive ground for which all these mental factors, which are rarely neutral and usually very active, they operate. Now, here's the relationship of Kipling's boats in. Right? So the mental factors and the main mind always relate to the same basis, meaning the same object. I'll just go through this quickly because our time's running up and we'll come to I can give the examples. Right? It's always the same object. The aspect is always the same. The time is always the same, simultaneous, and the substance. Both arise as a single substantial entity. In terms of time, they both arise, abide, and cease together. If you place your visual consciousness on an object, for instance, Intention, attention, contact, discernment, they're all there. You move it away, they all go away. Mental factors move too. They don't stay there. So I thought we'd start off with a couple of examples. So here are the phenomena. This is the relationship between the main mind and mental factors, right? And here are these five omnipresent mental factors. Feeling, contact, discernment, attention, and intention. So what I thought I'd do with you is to take you for the cup of tea. Primary consciousness perceives just the experience. You drink this tea or water like this, right? It's going to go like this, right? And what's the consciousness getting at it?
Gustatory.
Taste consciousness, right? Now, before I can actually taste that water, what's going to have to happen? Contact is going to have to be made, isn't it? Between this, my tongue, and that water and that tea. So contact takes place immediately, at the very same time. But even before that, I had an intention to drink the tea. My attention was on the tea. Then my tongue made contact with the tea. I discern that it is tea. And what's the feeling involved? I like it. These always go along together. And that's what, you know, I try and play around with it. So like you sort of get used to the idea of, these five things, yeah, they are happening together. And it's not like, you know, as soon as the contact is made, feeling arises immediately. But before feeling can arise, contact has to be made. So it's not, they don't all take place at the very, contact and feeling don't take place at the very same time. It's a contact of the moment the feeling arises. So you see this, and like I said, I decided I had attention, my tongue was paying attention to this taste. So that's a physical object, and I'd suggest if you were to do this, you start there because it's simple. Then move it to a mental object. For instance, what I want to put up here is something that was painful in the past. So when that happens, you're going to feel uncomfortable. So what's the feeling when you bring this object, this bad experience of the past? It's an unpleasant feeling. That unpleasant feeling can only take place because your mind has made contact with this mental object. It wouldn't arise otherwise. We decided to do that. I had an intention to do that. And my attention is actually on what I'm doing. And I discern it is this memory, not some other memory. What I find really great about this, you can see it's cause and effect. And if anything's cause and effect, you can interrupt it. Now you can change your experiences. Yeah, that's right. The causal process, huh? Yeah, so if you can see something's made up of parts, you know, the parts are not the same as each other, they're different. Then you can interrupt it. So this is one of the great things about, I think the Buddhism sort of shows us, the Buddhist model of the mind. Because it's a causal process, the effects will not follow if the causes are interrupted or changed slightly. So, you know, like I said, when we have memories of bad experiences, then we say we can't change the past. Right? You're right, the past is gone. But you can change your memory of the past. But you can change the meaning of the past memory. This is, from my perspective, really great knowledge. Let's do this last meditation, because I'll try to bring some of this stuff into mind. So again, we just get comfortable in your seat, drop your shoulders, straighten your back, close your eyes if you like. And then just generate a motivation to understand consciousness deeply. Knowing the depth of your understanding of your own consciousness can help you put an end to suffering and bring you to enlightenment, whereby you'll be able to benefit others to do the same. Now imagine you've got a cup of tea in your hand. What mental factors come into play as you put that cup of tea to your mouth and start to drink? Your tongue is going to make contact with that tea. A feeling about that tea will arise. You will discern something about that tea. Your attention is on the taste of the tea. And you had an intention to drink the tea. Five mental factors at play. Now think of a memory, either a good one or a bad one. You can even bring it to mind now and notice immediately that you're aware of it, your attention is on it, you've made contact with it. There's some sort of feeling that might arise from it. There's a discernment at play that it's this memory and not some other memory. The mental factors are at play, the mental objects and physical objects. And it's breathing into your nostrils. Exhale. It's your eyes wide open. So, you know what the main mind and mental functions are, hopefully. And what their purpose might be, how they function, and they share five features: the basis, object, aspect, time, and substance are the five features. I just know that because I think keep thinking boat. Okay, that's what they have. Mental factors and main causes have these things in common. Their five omnipresent mental factors is contact, discernment, feeling, intention, attention. I always have CIA in the fence. Right. We try little acronyms together to remember. And then the mental factors actually emerge from mind. They make the mind, five omnipresent mental factors are necessary for a main mind. If any of them are not there, the main mind cannot be there. Like they make it up. It's like the hand is made up of parts. The main mind is made up of parts. There are these omnipresent mental factors. We do have material up on the site. If you're going to have a look and read about it, some of it, you can have a look at on the LTC notes, pages 14 to 18, 36 to 39, and 44 to 46. Next, we're going to look at some of the other categories of mental factor. And within those categories, I want to sort of focus on feeling and talk about feeling because we place a lot of our emphasis and meaning on feelings. Okay, so we set off with a good motivation, altruistic motivation to study the mind. So then we're going to take the energy that we've expended in learning about mind and send it off in the direction of our goal. Now please join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme dual body teacher not yet born arise as well. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. Therefore, the long life of His Holiness. The wish granting, wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind, Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, the prayer for Arupasha's quick discovery and recognition. The holy and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings, your explanation and practice, you wore the arm of patience that was never discarded. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, and most instructors.